You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
I should put my mic on, that would help. Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lillian Hanley tōku e ingoa nui mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 24th of October. My name is Lillian Hanley. Kei konei tōku kai whakaputa a Lisa Baudet, anōnei a Alan Blackman. My producer Lisa is in studio with me along with Alan Blackman for Dear Science. Tēnā kōrua. How are you both?
Good. Yeah, just waiting for that mic to be turned on.
Yeah, that's right.
We're good.
All good.
Easing my way into it. How was the long weekend? Everyone have?
I was working the whole time, okay. So that wasn't fun.
And I was playing bowls the whole time.
Bowls?
Yes.
You're a bowls player?
Yeah. Lawn bowls.
Lawn bowls, absolutely.
Wow.
Oh, how good are you?
It's the sport. I was in the Auckland 1-8 rep team last year.
Oh, wait, we know this because you went on a competition and...
Yeah, very probably.
Weren't successful,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, no, probably not, but, you know, it's the trying
great,
that matters, you know. Right. Yeah.
If I can, coming up on the show today, for Dear Science, we talk about retracted research, germ-infested hand dryers, and the latest breakthrough award, which is worth more than the Nobel Prize. I did not know about this award. Angus Grant speaks to Thomas Nash prior to the launch of their new organisation, New Zealand Alternative, this morning. Ella Christensen looks into the effects on mental health from climate change for Worry Week this week. And Lisa Baudet takes us through the upcoming US midterm elections. Stay tuned for those. But first...
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Retracted research. A 16-year-old paper
Yep.
has been retracted that was based on a now debunked autism vaccine relationship study.
Indeed, yes.
Tell us more.
Well, the way that science works, the way that we, show our results to the world, is that we publish. And so we publish papers and they get published in journals and people read the journals and then they could then base their sort of future research on the stuff that's gone before, and so therefore they will credit the work that has been done before them, et cetera, and they'll reference that, and that's the way that science progresses. So, you know, as Isaac Newton said, you know, all standing on the shoulders of giants. So once a paper is in the literature, it's pretty much there for good unless there's something horribly, horribly wrong with it. And it so happens in 1998 that Andrew Wakefield, who you probably may well have heard of, published a paper saying that there was a link between vaccines and autism. There were a whole lot of things wrong with that particular paper. Number one, he didn't have ethical clearance for it. Mm. Number two, there was a very small sample size of 12 children, and these were not randomised, so these were self-selected. So that really doesn't work for stats and all that.
12 is not
a large number. Yep. And Wakefield was funded by lawyers for the family of the children.
Okay. So, well, how did this get published in the first place?
I thought you needed peer review.
That's a really good question. And yes, you do need peer review. And yes, it was published in The Lancet, which is, you know, Britain's best, medical journal. So... unfortunately, some stuff does slip through. I know.
Do you think it's because it was considered like, I don't know, it was like different? It was a different approach? It was groundbreaking or something? Like creating a correlation at a time where we needed an explanation or something?
Well, what's the quote? Remarkable results require remarkable evidence, I think. And, you know, somebody reading that would hopefully have thought, wow, you know, this is pretty amazing. Mm. But where's the proof? So whoever peer reviewed this really didn't do the job. And there's normally sort of two or three people peer review papers. So somehow it sneaked through, which is sad. And that led to a whole lot of rubbish over the sort of intervening
Years. What was the effect of this? People would have taken this and been like, right, I'm not going to vaccinate.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, it's still,
yes.
It's still current.
It's still ongoing.
People still link it.
It really is terrible, you know, that people still believe this, even though it's been retracted. But...
okay. Oh, yes, you've got a bat.
Yeah,
I've got a question.
Yeah. No, fire away.
Well, this was 88. When was it retracted?
This was 98. It was retracted in 2010, so it took an awful
long
time.
An
awful long time for it to be retracted, but it was. Now, the trouble is that even though it's been retracted, it still gets referenced in the literature by other papers. Okay?
Oh.
Yeah. Hmm. Now, a retraction, back in the days of sort of hard copy journals where they were just printed.
Oh, so you just couldn't find it anymore? Yeah. They just remove it from every copy?
No, but see, they can't remove it from a hard copy journal. So all through the libraries of the world, there will still be copies of this, yeah, and nobody will know it's retracted. However, in the electronic days now...
If you look it up
If you look it up online, it'll have a big retracted watermark through it.
Okay.
Okay, so that tells you that it's been retracted. But the trouble is there was a paper that made big use of this as a reference paper. It was a review paper, which looks at the literature and sort of reviews it down to a sort of a concise thing that everyone can read. And the trouble with that was that it relied very, very heavily on Wakefield's paper and basically sort of stating what was in that paper as fact, which we now know that it's not. And so this was a paper published in 2002. And again, it was sort of appearing a lot on sort of Google searches as proof of the link between vaccine and autism. So
is there not some sort of legal responsibility to then go and retract all of those? Not necessarily all the other papers, but then have that watermark through the reference.
No, there's not. There's no legal responsibility at all. It's completely up to the publishers. So the publishers of the journal choose whether or not they are going to retract it.
Okay.
Because it's their baby, basically. They own the copyright. So you sign over the copyright to them as soon as you publish a paper. So it's their decision. So, of course, they'll make that decision based on, you know, evidence, hopefully, and submissions from, you know, interested parties and stuff. And that's how this one came about, because sort of somebody was writing a paper on this sort of stuff, found this old paper in the literature and thought, no, this, you know, this can't be. We can't let this be still in the literature. And so... even though it was published in 2002, it's only just been retracted sort of in the last month. And
properly.
Properly, yes. So if you now go and look at it up, it's still there on the website, but it does have a big retracted watermark through
it. But there could potentially be more papers written with that as a reference that haven't been retracted yet.
And that's the problem. That's why you can't have... Well, that's the problem with having crap in the literature, because it still gets referenced, because authors are lazy. Because they don't go back and look at the original paper. They just say, oh, shit, this paper referenced it, so I'll reference it because it must be relevant to the sort of stuff I'm doing, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and if you just trust in the system as well, you kind of hope that if it's there and it's being referenced, then that's fine.
Yeah, yeah,
so it's been peer-reviewed by three different people, three people.
So. Yep, and they got it wrong. They got it spectacularly wrong in this case. So I guess you can sort of say that this is the self-correcting nature of science that us scientists always sort of go on about so proudly, but by crikey, it takes a while.
Mm. Yeah, in terms of the turnover, I guess, is the issue here, right? Because if it gradually, the papers that reference it will not.
Yes.
You know, you'll end up not referencing it anymore. Yeah.
And, you know, Wakefield's paper's 20 years old now, and sort of in scientific terms, that's, you know, it's pretty much a dinosaur, you know. Enormous things have happened in the past 20 years. So... hopefully it's just sort of going to die a natural death, and any papers that have referenced it and are themselves referenced hopefully will sort of go the same way. But
I do like that it's still available to see that sort of, I guess, a paper trail of change and new experiments and new discoveries and new proof, I guess, new evidence. But we can go back and you can see that at one point...
Yes.
I mean, this is not probably the best example given this is quite an outlier.
Yeah, but, you know, I guess it sort of serves as possibly a warning to people who are thinking of, you know, let's see what I can get away with publishing, because the way that it works now, it's there forever and a day. You are now the publisher or the author of a retracted study, and nobody wants to be the author of a retracted study because that doesn't really reflect
well on you. Do you think it would not happen now? Are there more
it still happens. It really does.
People publish.
Yep.
Not 100%.
People knowingly publish fake data. Yep.
Why? What's in it for them?
Because they need to get ahead. Because they want to get a good job. They want to probably get an academic job out of it. And there are numerous, sadly, examples of like PhD students have just made up results that their supervisor wanted, and they have published them in the very, very best journals, which then basically sets them up for life, because then they go on and do a good postdoc and then they get a good academic job, et cetera, et cetera. But they're going to get caught in the end. They just are.
Do they?
Yes, oh yes.
There are people that are onto this sort of thing and they do monitor it?
Yes, yes, most definitely.
But is it 40 years later once you've already been set up?
No, not really. Because if you make an astounding discovery, then the first thing that people are going to try and do is replicate it.
And check it.
Yeah. So probably people get away with a lot of crap in a lot of poor journals, but that's not where you want to be publishing if you want to make your name. You want to publish good stuff in Nature and Science and all of these really, really good journals. They're going to be checked.
So bottom line is that good journals should probably be a bit more, like paying a bit more attention to what they're publishing.
Well, they, you know,
you expect them to.
Yeah, every time something like this happens, you know, they get burnt, their reputation suffers, so they don't want this sort of thing to happen. So I, in a perverse sort of way, this probably does science some good because it sort of tightens up on the rules of peer review, et cetera, et cetera. Would be my feeling on this. So that's the story anyway. So okay. it is now out of the literature.
Retracted.
Literally. Sorry.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. Moving into germs on hand dryers, which is, I feel like this is not really a new thing. We probably realise that hand dryers are probably quite filthy.
But did we? This all came as news to me, I've got to say.
Well, because you think that because you've washed your hands before, whatever's coming out of your hand in the hand dryer is washed thing. So what, bacteria-free?
Well, the whole reason for these things, where they were probably sort of touted as being really, really healthy or whatever, because you didn't have to touch
anything. You don't touch anything.
Then, you know, no touch hand dryers, you know. And so that must be a good thing, surely. But
it's not.
But it's not. So about four or so years ago, there was a bunch of folk in England and France and Italy, and they decided to look at this question of whether or not these air hand dryers or jet dryers or whatever you want to call them were in fact better than just using good old paper towels. And so they did some sort of laboratory experiments, so not sort of real world ones, and they showed that yes, in fact, paper towels were much better, and in fact that these jet dryers, what they succeeded in doing was simply blowing bacteria off your hands into the air onto neighbouring surfaces, and at about 27 times more bacteria in the air than you'd get with just using paper towels. Okay. Oh. And the root cause of all this is apparently people don't know how to wash their hands properly.
Right. So
if you have improperly washed hands, you throw them in these air dryers and that just blows all of the bugs all over the show.
So it isn't necessarily the concept of hand dryers. The problem lies with the washing of the hands.
Seemingly, yes.
Like people that just put their hands under the water.
Give them a quick dribble.
Don't actually put any sanitizer or anything.
Yeah. So they have recently looked into this in a real-world situation. So this year they were studying hospital bathrooms in hospitals
Pretty
in England.
Important.
Yeah, very. So in England and in France and in Italy. And so the way they did it was a 12-week period, so 12-week study. In the first 4 weeks, they would have one of paper towels or the jet dryers available in the hospital bathroom. Okay. Then they had a 2-week break for everything to sort of clear up, and then they would change it. So they would then go for the opposite one. They'd have the jet dryer present if it was the paper towels present first up. That for 4 weeks, and then another 2-week break, and then they go back to the original for another 4 weeks. So this is a 12-week intensive study, and what they would do was they would monitor the air for bacteria and monitor all of the and swab the surfaces and stuff and have a look at how much bacteria were in the
is
air
it like every
on
day,
surfaces.
Every
Yeah. So, you know, this is pretty intensive stuff. Mm. And what they found was, yes, the same thing, that when you had the air dryer there, that you had significantly more bacterial levels than you had with the paper towels.
Okay.
Like in Italy, we're talking 100 times more, France 33 times more, England 22 times more.
So Italians can't wash their hands properly.
Oh, let's not make generalisations, guys.
Yeah, I know the French and the Italians don't get on. I know, but that's a bit
harsh.
No,
we're also terrible at this. It's fine.
But okay, okay, if there is more bacteria in the air, technically, the bacteria is not really on your hands.
Yeah.
So regardless of which way you dry your hands, you yourself are clean.
I don't think that's the problem.
Just pointing that out.
But it can become quite dangerous in a hospital situation
when you're in that space.
How do you call those nosocomial?
The super bugs and stuff and So
well, then you can get infected.
So anyone going into that space may pick up
the
bacteria, regardless of whether your hands are clean or not.
Yep.
And that can create complications.
And, you know, all you got to do is touch something, and then you know, and you've got it. And that's not good. So
aren't we at the point though where We're aware that, you know, getting rid of like the entirety of germs on our hands is a bad thing. Shouldn't we be maintaining
in a hospital? It's a good
some
thing.
Some bacterial.
Yeah, I know. And there's a lot of debate about sort of this whole antibacterial sort of soaps and things like that. And yeah, I'm sure you're right. You know, there seem to be so many more allergies these days than there were when I was a kid and everything. And this is sort of being ascribed to overuse of these sort of cleaners and stuff. So,
but yeah, I see your point in a hospital. Mm.
However, now there's a big however to this.
Okay.
Okay, so reading the paper, the actual paper that this was published in, you go to the bottom.
Wow, you do some good research for this.
Well, hey, I don't just sort of read it 5 minutes beforehand and then rock up. Hell no, you know.
All right,
I'll just look at the headline.
This is my Wednesday morning's gone.
You know? In the paper.
So you read the paper and right at the bottom, it said that the research was funded by the European Tissue Symposium.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
People that have an interest in selling paper
towels.
There
you go.
Wow.
Yeah, wow indeed. Okay.
This is not a new thing, though. This would happen all over. Yeah. We've just talked about that in the past story.
But for goodness sake, we've got to sort of be seen to be above all of this possible, you know, corruption or whatever you want to call it, or, you know, favours for money and all, you know.
Seems to be happening in politics, though, doesn't it?
Oh, so. Bugger politics. We don't care about politics anymore. It's science. But, you know,
science is political.
Well, it shouldn't be. That's the thing.
But,
science
shouldn't be. Surprised that it isn't like an independent thing, that you can have private corporations that actually pay for things. Although you'd like to think that the system in place for methodology and all that in scientific research would prevent you from being subject to outside influence.
Hopefully, but you know, the question's always going to be there. If you're funded by somebody who's got a vested interest in the results that you get, then the results that you get are always going to be open to question. Always.
Yeah.
And you don't want that. And especially if there's, you know, these are pretty important results, I would have said. And so, they're you know, these people are advocating for basically removing jet dryers in hospital bathrooms. Putting,
okay, but if given these results are important, is it not good that the results are there, regardless of how they got there?
Well, yes and no. You know, that now the dryer industry are probably going to go out with their own bloody stuff. You know how it is. You know, it's like the tobacco industry. Yeah, of course. And it's
never ending circle. It is. You never find out what's actual.
What is the truth? The truth about it.
Jesus.
Okay, yeah, let's finish on a positive.
Okay,
perhaps.
Yes.
What
yes.
is the breakthrough award?
Well, indeed, I was sort of unaware that these things existed as well, but these have been going since 2012. The Breakthrough Prize, it's called. And this is funded by such people as Sergey Brin from Google and Mark Zuckerberg from we all know where. Mm-hmm. And so there are nine or maximum of nine of these awards given out every year for life sciences, fundamental physics and mathematics. And up to three people can win these each year. And they are worth $3 million a pop.
So each person.
Each person.
So that's
indeed.
$9 million a year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where's this money coming from?
Well, it's $9 million per subject, so it's $27 million for the whole lot. Yeah, I know. Well, I think Facebook and Google are doing rather well. So
they have lots of money to invest in research.
Well, we're still in the same thing as what we were just talking about.
Exactly. It's not that positive.
Who's investing in this stuff?
Well, somebody's got to give the prizes, don't they? But yeah, no, I know. But, you know, as you say, this is worth more than the Nobel Prize. The total prize pool for each Nobel Prize is $1 million, I think, about $1 million US at the moment, just a touch less. So this is worth significantly more than the Nobel Prize. Instead of being awarded by sort of the King of Sweden or whoever actually does the thing at the big dinner, this one was hosted by Pierce Brosnan.
Oh.
On the National Geographic Channel.
What?
Yes. Yeah, I think they need maybe a higher caliber of host. So apparently it's been hosted by Seth MacFarlane of Family Guy fame for the last few years.
Oh, so they
Family Guy's quite funny.
I do.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's not, you know,
it's,
serious.
Yeah, it's hardly highbrow, is it? Let's be honest.
Well, I guess they're, I don't know.
But anyway, so there's a researcher by the name of Zhaowei Zhuang at Harvard. And Harvard, for goodness sake. Sound like I live in Boston. And she invented this thing called super resolution imaging, which was about 10 or so years ago. And basically what she did was to allow us to see things that we shouldn't be able to see, really.
Really little things.
Really little things, okay. Normally to see really little things, we'd use a light microscope.
Mm-hmm.
And so you look down and you see these, you know, amazing things blown up and everything, but there's a limit to what you can see. There's a limit to the size of things that you can see in a light microscope simply because of the wavelength of light. Okay, and you can't see anything smaller than the wavelength of light, which is around about, you know, it goes from 400 to 700 nanometers.
So very, very small.
Very, very small, okay? So in order to actually see smaller than that, we can use things like electron microscopes and stuff like that, you know, which are all sort of an indirect way of seeing these things. But she came up with a really, really nice, really, really nice way of doing this. She'd get these molecules that she wanted to look at, and she'd put little fluorescent molecules. She'd attach these fluorescent molecules to these other molecules, okay? Now, we might not be able to see things smaller than 200 nanometers or 400 nanometers or whatever, but what we can see is flashes of light, okay?
Okay.
We're really, really good at seeing flashes of light. And that's what happens with these fluorescent molecules. They flash, okay? You hit them with a laser beam, and they actually flash. And they do it randomly. Okay, so you don't know which one's going to flash at any given time. So if you've got a collection of these molecules, you want to know what their shape is, you just hit them with a laser and they flash, and they do it again, and they do it again, and a different one does it again, and a different one does it again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these little flashes of light until you build up basically a big picture of what the whole thing looks like. It's really, really, really nice. And again, it's one of these things that's sort of obvious in hindsight. You think, shit, I could have thought of that, but didn't, you know.
Don't know. That sounds pretty complicated.
Really, really elegant
stuff. And also drawing it, wouldn't it be, I mean, if they're flashing randomly, you wouldn't know when that's going to stop. Or
no, but you've got your little detector, which will, you know, sort
which
that
will
out
line
for you.
It all up.
Yeah.
So you're mapping them out.
Yeah, basically, okay. And it's all to do with visible light. So you're using visible light to be able to see very, very small things.
May I just ask what the point is?
Or what this will be used for?
Yeah.
To look at things essentially in vivo or in vitro, really. Okay, so if you're going to do sort of electron microscopy, you've got to take your sample and you've got to prepare it and you've got to put it in a vacuum and everything, blah, 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 blah. This you can use on living things. So all you've got to do is tag your living molecules or whatever, with these little fluorescent molecules, just attach them to the molecule itself, and then away you go. So you can sort of do real-time monitoring of what's going on in things like cells and stuff like that. It really is
amazing.
Seriously impressive.
Also, yep. I guess what it's for is winning $9 million.
Indeed, yes.
But can I ask, do the people that win these prizes, do they have to use that money for further
research?
Not the Nobel Prizes. No, they don't have to.
They just use that for life.
Yeah. And Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who Marcus would have spoken about a few weeks ago, so she was the PhD student who didn't get the Nobel Prize and her boss did.
Yeah.
So she just got given a special one of these, a month or two ago, I think.
Yeah.
And Marcus spoke about this, and she's giving the whole lot away.
Whoa.
She's giving a whole lot away to research.
She's giving it away
$3 million US bucks.
To kind of like help
women
with,
in physics, I think.
Help with diversity.
Yep.
In the research.
Absolutely
field.
Stunning. Yeah. Absolutely stunning. What a philanthropist, for goodness sake. So
caller. Hello.
Ooh. Hi. I'm just a little confused. If you can't see these things until you've got this light on them, how do you put the fluorescent light on them?
Good point.
You just shine the light at them, basically. You know they're in your test tube somewhere or whatever it is that you're looking at. And so once you've stuck your little fluorescent molecules onto them...
But that's what he's asking.
Yeah,
how do you put the fluorescent...
Oh, that's easy. That's just chemistry. You just mix them up.
So you just mix it with...
You basically just mix it with your fluorescent molecule. You get a chemical reaction. The fluorescent molecule sticks to it. And then once that's stuck to it, then you can tell exactly where it is.
All right. Brilliant. Thank you, caller.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we should probably leave it there.
We shall, except for one thing, if I may, or two things. Okay.
Yes, okay.
So speaking of winning... Could I just very humbly say that the Brofessors won the National Pub Quiz Championship for the second year in a row.
I'll make sure to pass that on to Will.
On Saturday, because Will will be impressed
by
that.
Will be very impressed.
And also yesterday, it's the Earth's birthday yesterday.
Earth's birthday?
The Earth's birthday, because the Earth was created on the 23rd of October 4004 BC, according to Bishop Usher.
When you say created.
Created. Yes.
As in the Big Bang.
No, the big God.
Oh,
yes. Yeah, so we looked back through the Bible, all the begatting and begatting and begatting and begatting and figured it out. It was 4004
BC. We can see that
BC.
I don't know my religious history.
Sarcastic here.
Would I be sarcastic?
Okay, we're going to wrap it up. A couple of people have texted in, though. Hot air must multiply germs, gag, poop germs. Yes. Perhaps making all toilet exit doors push, not pull, would be a simple improvement, especially in hospitals.
Somebody's thinking. I like that.
And lots of scientific research affects results anyway, for fuck's sake. We'll leave it there. See you next week, Alan.
See you.
That was Dear Science. Coming to the Tuning Fork January 21st, Idols. Leftist post-punk giants Idols, bringing their hyperactive, infectious live show to NZ. Idols, January 21st at the Tuning Fork. Tickets on sale this Friday from Ticketmaster.
OMG, I'm obsessed with this podcast.
Oh, True Crime Histories. Or Grimm's Missingsville. Is it Criminal Yarns? Craig T. Nelson's Murder Tales.
No.
Oh, I got it. Tragedy Vultures. I love Tragedy Vultures.
Nah, it's one of the other ones where they watch bad movies.
Tacky.
Expand your podcast horizons. All of 95BFM's excellent shows and segments are available as podcasts on iTunes, RSS, or whatever podcatcher you're into. Never miss out again. 95BFM Vcasts. Subscribe to your favorite shows now.
Oh, New Year's Eve, a time of reawakening and renewal. Take those dirty, bad 2018 feelings and transform them into Wonder Garden, the best New Year's Eve fest this side of the Bombays, nestled right in the heart of Auckland City, featuring the likes of Dane Funk, Jess B, Cut Off Your Hands, and Nightmares on Wax DJ set. If you want to get your New Year's Eve stuff for free, then just grab your Simplicity B card and stay tuned to 95BFM for your chance to win. Wonder Garden, December 31st at Silo Park. Get along to wondergarden.co.nz. The Wire.
Thomas Nash, along with Laura O'Connell Rapida, Max Harris and Nina Hall, have established an organisation called New Zealand Alternative, aiming to widen the public conversation around Aotearoa, New Zealand's role in the world. It's been stated that the organisation will do research, policy development and advocacy to help shape a truly independent, values-driven foreign policy for Aotearoa as a South Pacific country. Its first publication was released this morning, titled Aotearoa New Zealand and Conflict Prevention. Angus Coker-Grant spoke with Thomas Nash to find out more and started by asking what exactly the New Zealand Alternative is. Just a note to remember, this interview was conducted yesterday and speaks of the launch as being tomorrow, but it was in fact this morning.
New Zealand Alternative is a new independent organisation, and the goal is to open up more public discussion around the role of Aotearoa New Zealand in the world. We've noticed that this is foreign policy and our role in the world as a country tends to be a little bit neglected in terms of public discussion and perhaps even shielded from public scrutiny. So our first goal is really to open up space for that, and including by broadening the sort of group of people who tend to comment on and engage in discussion, get some fresh perspectives into that space. And the other kind of aspect, I guess, to this is that we have quite strong progressive values. We'd like to see New Zealand playing an independent role, promoting values around environmental justice, around peace and humanitarian work, feminist foreign policy, decolonisation, indigenous rights, alternative models of economics and trade, and some of these areas that tend to be a bit marginalised in discussion. So, yeah, that's the basic plan.
Sounds quite ambitious. With tomorrow, I understand you're holding a conference.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, it is ambitious, and you know, we're all the four co-founders, Max Harris, Laura O'Connell-Rapida, Nina Hall, and myself. We're all fairly active people and keen to engage in public discussion and public debate. So yeah, I think we're quite hopeful that this will be able to build up some partnerships with other organisations and groups to help make this work happen. But yeah, tomorrow, Wednesday morning, 10 a.m. at the National Library in Wellington, we will be launching our first piece of research and policy writing. It's called the report is called Aotearoa New Zealand and Conflict Prevention. And what we've done is we've interviewed about 30 experts from in New Zealand and around the world to talk about the role New Zealand could play internationally in helping to prevent conflict and to engage in peace mediation work. And we've got a recommendation there that the government should set up an independent conflict prevention unit that would be able to develop a capacity for New Zealand to play a role internationally in helping to end conflict and prevent conflict. And we've got a budget for that and timeline. So, yeah, we've been quite specific on this front.
So the first, your first goal or first focus is on conflict prevention?
Yes, exactly. That's our first piece of detailed policy work. And we imagine that as we go along, we'll be keen to put out some policy work and research and recommendations on a range of other aspects of foreign policy and New Zealand's role in the world.
Are there any sort of these independent conflict prevention like organisations overseas?
Yeah, so we spoke to some experts who work for the Swiss government and for the Norwegian government and also looked at folks working in the German context. And we looked briefly at Ireland, South Africa and Finland. These are all countries that have traditionally and are still playing a role on conflict prevention and peace mediation. And quite a number of them have quite substantial institutional capacity at the national level within the governments for peace mediation and conflict prevention. We think that New Zealand building up that capacity would be really important. And I think we can learn from what other countries have done, but also I think we can put our own mark on it as a country with our own history and identity.
And so you don't think New Zealand's maybe a little bit too small on the global scale for this to work effectively, or will we be totally fine?
Well, interestingly, being small and non-threatening and pragmatic is usually helpful.
So that can be the New Zealand mark on it then?
Yeah, exactly. And also, similar to countries like Ireland and Norway and Switzerland, they're relatively small countries, not threatening, able to be quite sort of pragmatic and practical, and also quite agile. So we think this is probably, we're probably well suited to this. Of course, it will take time to build up and develop the experience and expertise, but there's plenty of New Zealanders who are working in international humanitarian and peacekeeping organisations and missions around the world. So we think we've got a lot of good people and expertise and history to draw on.
How is New Zealand currently doing in terms of foreign policy and so on?
I think New Zealand has a reputation internationally for being quite progressive on foreign policy, and obviously when you look back, you've got the sort of nuclear-free identity which looms large in people's minds for something that really made us stand out on the international stage. We've also done things that are less well-known in terms of maritime law and the Convention on the Law of the Sea and various sort of technical things like that, and obviously we've got a good name for ourselves in trade negotiations, although one can look at that in different ways, of course. But I think New Zealand really is probably at a bit of a crossroads now, where it has an opportunity, particularly with this new-ish government, to really decide what kind of foreign policy footprint it wants to have in this really troubled and uncertain world that we're living in. And we really hope that part of our goal as an organisation and with this report and others that will follow, we really hope that this government and future governments will decide to really make the most of our privileged position as a country, as a small, non-threatening country, to promote values of justice and peace and democracy, equal rights that I think a lot of Kiwis, most Kiwis, hopefully all Kiwis hold dear.
Do you have any final comments?
I guess I could say, as we move forward as an organisation, we're just starting. We're quite sort of humble in starting out in this area where there are a lot of experts and a lot of past work. We've tried with this report to include as many voices as we can, but We really want to do as much as we can to provide a platform for fresh perspectives. So migrant communities, Māori, Pacifica, groups that don't necessarily get as much airtime or as much of a platform to speak about New Zealand's role in the world. So that's what we're here for, and we're really open to partnerships with others to help increase the diversity of voices that we see in the world of foreign policy and New Zealand's role in the world.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
That was Thomas Nash and our Worry Week piece. We all know climate change is a problem. It is generally portrayed as an exclusively biophysical problem that will impact things like our weather and oceans, agriculture and water availability. But climate change also has an impact on mental health. To discuss the ways climate change is currently and will continue to have an effect on mental health globally and here in New Zealand, Ella Christensen spoke with David Menkes, Associate Professor of Psychological Medicine in the Auckland University Medical School. She began by asking him to explain what current and future risks to mental health we face as a result of climate change.
I mean, it's a big topic, and I think so we can really only, you know, touch on a few of the categories without going into a whole lot of detail. But certainly there are sort of the direct physical impacts of climate change, including, I guess, most conspicuously, sea level rise, where we've got some striking examples in our Pacific neighbors of, you know, actual loss of habitable land. But probably more significant on a global scale is going to be the frequency of extreme weather events. And there seems no doubt at all that, you know, the frequency and severity of extreme weather has increased in various parts of the planet. And we haven't had a whole lot of that here, but in other parts of the world, major impacts in terms of drought and flooding and extreme weather of various sorts. So it has been quite disruptive, and a lot of people have been killed, and many, many more have been displaced by the extreme weather. And I guess this is really just a taster of what might be on the horizon if we continue on the path we are. And certainly both the sea level rise and the extreme weather events would be expected to increase over the coming decades.
And along those lines then, I'm wondering, what is the role of mental health conversations as these massive changes are happening? Because for people who, I think for most people, it's going to be extremely disruptive and unexpected. And it seems that that's going to have an emotional and psychological impact.
Absolutely. Hey, look, there's something you may have seen in the paper we wrote about how the World Health Organization has, you know, stepped up to address this challenge. And it really is big ups to them for having put this, you know, center stage on the priority list. And so what they say is that climate change will be the defining issue for health systems in the 21st century. I mean, that's it. That's the top of the list. I'd probably put the threat of nuclear war up there somewhere.
Yeah.
given
apparently,
the event of last
week. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's on the list. But here it is. Number one, they say, is climate change. And they go on to say that health professionals have the knowledge, cultural authority, and responsibility to protect health from climate change. Okay, big task, and, you know, we cannot shirk that responsibility. In many cases, we're not going to really be able to prevent it. We're going to have to be talking about damage control and mitigation, because it's already happening. There are already people dying. There are already streams of refugees that are set to increase over the coming decades. So we've really got to gear up. And I think, you know, health systems generally, but including mental health, we need to get ready for this. And because, you know, even if we, you know, stopped burning fossil fuels today, we still have that huge signal that's going to continue to disrupt climate for the next decades. Mm-hmm. Even if we slow down and turn that ship around, you know, we're going to have to be dealing with this. And the problem is, of course, that if we don't slow that ship down and turn it around, it's going to get worse and possibly cataclysmic if we reach that tipping point of 1.5 or 2 degrees warming.
There's not a lot of indication that the changes necessary are happening right now. So
no, indeed not. And I guess your listeners will probably be aware of some of the reasons for that tipping point. It now seems, you know, pretty clear that, you know, once we cross that threshold, if we don't, you know, do something pretty drastic, pretty quick, we will get there. And once that happens, apparently one of the main triggers is the melting of a lot of ice in Arctic and subarctic regions, tundra, et cetera, you know, like across the Eurasian landmass. Mm-hmm. Apparently when the ice covering that tundra melts, a whole lot of trapped methane comes out,
mm-hmm.
right? So we get what's called the runaway effect, or a positive feedback loop, where you get past that threshold, a bit more warming leads to a process that generates more and more warming, and so on it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what we need to prevent. It's absolutely critical that we somehow slow the ship down before we get to that tipping point. And, you know, the estimates are that we could do it. It's still possible to do it, but time is literally of the essence here.
I wonder what your maybe suggestions are for people who, because hearing all of this information is very overwhelming, and I sort of wonder if people aren't as engaged or active around climate change because of that reason.
Absolutely, no, that's certainly true, and you could make the same argument about the risk of nuclear weapons being used.
Mm.
That it's, you know, so huge and almost unfathomable what could happen, that it's easier just not to think about it. Of course, that's not a very adaptive thing in the long run, and our children and grandchildren will not thank us for it.
Mm.
So we really need to, you know, kind of grapple with reality. And I think, you know, the way to do that is to realize that, yeah, there is a difference that ordinary people can make. And one of the main things we can do is keep it on the agenda, keep talking about it as you and I are right now. You know, talk to your neighbors, talk to your friends, and, you know, wherever possible, bring it into the here and now. Do you really need to drive to the shop? You know, like, you know, what's wrong with a bike? You know, what's wrong with walking? If you can, if there's an alternative, go for it. I mean, I'm happily in a department at the university that enables this sort of thing by allowing us to, you know, meet with pretty good audiovisual technology. So I'm meeting with my department in Grafton, for example, a couple times a month via Zoom, you know, and it saves that, you know, tedious trip up and down to Auckland. My attitude might change, incidentally, once we get a regular rail service running between Hamilton and Auckland. But in the meantime, going up and down that road is sort of the last thing I want to do with half a day. And so, you know, accordingly, there's all these little decisions that we make about how we manage our day-to-day lives. And, you know, I think it is important, not so much for the absolute contribution it makes to, you know, reducing, in this case, fossil fuel consumption, but also the you know, the sort of collective vibe of what we do and how we communicate and how we live. You know, that should be out there. It should be talked about. It should be celebrated. And I think, you know, that it's just something that needs to be much more visible and part of day-to-day life and conversation.
Yeah, there's a... It seems like there's kind of this strange social silence around climate change when I bring it up often, and it feels like conversations don't go very far because people are kind of like, oh, yeah, that sucks. Yeah, it's terrible. And that's kind of it.
Yeah, and part of that surely comes from the sense that, oh, well, we can't do anything about it, and, you know, the world is screwed, and, you know, what the hell. Might as well just, you know, enjoy, you know, what we can while it's here, kind of thing. You know, ultimately, you got to understand that there's a lot of people who think that way, and that we've got to manage that sort of, you know, disconnection from reality. I think they outnumber the deniers, actually, the apathetic middle who probably would, you know, accept the scientific evidence and probably agree, if they bothered to think about it or talk about it, that, yeah, well, this is probably happening, and, yeah, we probably all are, in a way, contributing, but it's too big a problem, and, you know, I just can't think about that now because I've got, you know, my own life to live, or, you know, an exam to study for, or a job to do, or whatever it is. You know, people conveniently shut it out when it seems unmanageable or too big or too scary. And I think we need to break that down and just bring it home to people, is that, yeah, that's a very common experience. That's a human way of dealing with things. But another human way of dealing with things is by keeping it out there, keeping it, you know, in the public discourse, and making sure that how you live is consistent with those values and that understanding.
I also wonder what you have to say about guilt in relation to this issue, because as just from my personal experience, trying to make all of these individual behavior changes can sometimes make me feel constantly guilty and kind of neurotic about my behavior, because once you start becoming aware of these issues, it's in everything that you do, and it can be kind of difficult to try to do the right thing all the time when often there's not a good choice.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think this comes back to another, you know, aspect of human nature, really, that in terms of motivating any kind of behavior, but in this case, motivating, you know, responsible, socially useful behavior, like, you know, living well and doing what you can to look after the planet, that there's an optimal level of concern or motivation. And if, you know, if you have too little or too much, you tend to either not bother, get, you know, paralyzed with anxiety or guilt. So really, we want to help people, you know, calibrate to that happy middle ground where they're concerned but not paralyzed.
Yeah.
You want people to understand that, hey, you know, we're all in this, and, you know, different people have different thresholds for behaving well and responsibly. And I think what we need to do is allow for a lot of individual, you know, difference in that respect, and encourage people to find, if you like, their sweet spot, where they are, you know, engaged and motivated, but not subject to, you know, too much in the way of guilt or paralysis. So everybody's different. Everybody's got their own formula. But I think recognizing the fact that we do have that optimal level of concern and motivation to really do any kind of productive behavior. So that might be, you know, studying for an exam, getting a job application together, you know, organizing a party, whatever it is you mean to do. You can have too much or too little, and what we want is just right, you know, that happy middle ground of enough concern ideally in concert with other people. So, I mean, we are in this together, and that's why I think, you know, keeping it on the agenda to be speaking with your friends and your family and your neighbors and whoever about this stuff is perfectly legit, and it should be much more the norm that things that are that important receive the appropriate amount of airplay. So I guess that's a good note on which to refer back to the radio show that you're doing, because this is, you know, exactly what should be out there and for people to be thinking about and responding to.
Māori grievances about land are historical. We didn't wake up in the 1970s all angry and protesty and, you know, started demanding our things back.
The Wire.
His songs have been recorded by the likes of Bruce Springsteen, Johnny Cash and Emmylou Harris. Now he's returning to New Zealand for the first time in 25 years.
I'm knocking on your screen door in the summertime.
95BFM's Border Radio presents John Prine, February 27th at the Bruce Mason Centre. Don't miss this intimate performance by the songwriter's songwriter, John Prine. February 27th at the Bruce Mason Centre. Tickets on sale now from frontiertouring.com/John Prine.
It's music. BFM, the original originator. Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95BFM.com.
The Wire.
So today I wanted to talk about the upcoming midterm elections in the United States. They're not coming until the November 6th, but I still felt like it was good timing to talk about it. Donald Trump was elected a little bit under 2 years ago, and so it's a rule in the American political regime that U.S. electors are voting halfway through this presidential mandate, which is what we call midterm elections. So I'm not sure that every listener knows exactly what they are, so I'm kind of going to walk people through that. So what are people voting for? Well, they're choosing new members of the Congress. Now, the Congress is the combination of the two American parliamentary chambers. We've got the House of Representatives and the Senate. They both work together to write and pass laws, but the Senate has a little bit extra power. For instance, confirming the president's choice of judges and senior government officials, that is Attorney General or Supreme Court nominees, like we've just seen with Brett Kavanaugh being nominated and then later confirmed by the U.S. Senate. Now, all members of Congress are not being re-elected. All 435 seats in the House of Representatives are up for election, so this whole chamber is going to be renewed, but only 35 out of 100 senator seats are being voted for. And because senators are being elected for 6 years, so their terms are staggered so that about a third of the seats are up for election every 2 years. So the senators that are going to be elected on November 6th will remain in the Senate until 2022. And members of the House of Representatives are only serving a two-year term. So the face of the House can actually change quite dramatically compared to that of the Senate, which is a bit more settled. So why are we talking so much about these elections? Well, obviously, US electors are voting for their local representatives, but also historically, midterm elections are pretty much a referendum on the country's leader and his action. In this instance, Donald Trump, he is very aware of this and he's been rallying around the country quite a bit and saying things like a vote for said candidate is a vote for me. So he's really making it a personal affair, which he should, because that's kind of how it works over there. And so these elections could actually have quite big repercussions on the remaining years of the presidential mandate for the next couple of years, because the Congress passes the law. It's an incredible asset for the president to have a majority there. Currently, both houses of the Congress have a Republican majority, which means that President Trump has theoretical support for whatever reforms he wants to see pass. That includes, for instance, building a wall at the Mexican border, replacing Obamacare, or reinstating the family separation policy at the border, for instance. So those are things that Trump has said that he wanted to do. And if he keeps that majority and he keeps having the support of the Congress, then he will more than likely be able to pass said policies. So who's going to win is something that people would like to know. I don't think we can really, I don't think we have like a clear winner. But obviously, if we look at opinion polls, which people tend to do, the Democrats could actually do pretty well. At the moment, if they want to take control of the House of Representatives, they have to claim 23 or more seats from the Republicans. It might not be actually as hard as it looks, primarily because a lot of Republicans are stepping down this year for whatever reason. Some just don't want to be elected again or run for elections or just want different jobs, I suppose. But what that means is that there's going to be a lot of new faces that electors are going to have to decide whether to vote for or not, which kind of reshuffles the cards a little bit and so makes it a bit harder to predict, but there is room for change. Basically, the Republicans have 42 seats that are considered at risk of being lost. And so if the Democrats claim 23 of these and don't lose the ones that they currently have, then they'll have a majority. For the Senate, that could actually be a little bit harder to overturn because more than half of those 35 seats that are up for election are already pretty safe Democrat seats. So there's kind of less room for gaining ground, but it's not impossible. So what does it mean for Donald Trump? Well, like I said before, the US system is made in a way that only functions properly if the president has a majority in both chambers. Otherwise, it's pretty much gridlock. So that's what happened to Barack Obama. He got elected in 2008, and during his first term, he lost the midterm elections in 2010, quite dramatically. And so he lost the majority at both the Senate and the House of Representatives, which meant that it made it really hard for him to be able to pass the laws that he wanted to do. And if you look at his most known policies like healthcare, there were things that he did in the first 2 years of his first term. After that, it was really hard for him to pass anything. And so that could, a similar thing was to happen to Donald Trump, that could make his, he could have way less of a margin to push his agenda forward. And then, so what does it mean for President Trump personally? Well, that could also mean a vote for impeachment, which is something that we've been talking about quite a bit. Before, when there were allegations of Russian meddling in the election campaign in 2016. For an impeachment procedure, you need a majority of vote at the House of Representatives. So that's probably the reason it hasn't happened yet, is because the majority at the moment belongs to the Republicans, who have little interest in impeaching a president that is Republican as well. Now, if the chamber becomes Democrat, well, has a Democrat majority, there is a chance that this majority, which is needed to vote for impeachment, will indeed vote for impeachment. That doesn't actually mean that the impeachment procedure is going to go all the way, because not only do you need that majority vote, but then you also need 2/3 of the Senate to find the president guilty for him to be removed. So if you have majority at the House of Representatives, which votes for impeachment, but then your Senate stays Republican, or at least 2/3 not Democrat, then it could be quite hard for that to go all the way. So, yeah, Trump's probably safe for a little while longer, I'd say. And so what's next? Well, obviously, these elections are going to be a good indicator of the country's power balance before the 2020 election. Obviously, it will tell us whether Donald Trump has the support base that he claims he has. So that's going to be interesting. Also, with the 2020 elections in sight, let's not forget that during these midterm elections, voters also elect their state governors. So these are pretty much head of state, not the federal state, but head of state, like local state. And so these people have a big influence on people's daily lives, because in that federal state configuration, a lot of things that touch on at people's everyday life are being decided at the state level, not the federal state level. So governors are actually quite, they have quite a big influence in people's votes. They also are able to raise a lot of money. And so they make really good allies for presidential campaigns. So that, how many governors of each party will kind of, could make a difference in the 2020 election. Now, one thing that I just wanted to touch on before
the end is voter suppression, which maybe I should talk about how historically midterm elections have seen a very low turnout. It's quite, so like presidential elections are usually 50 to 60% turnout, but midterms elections are more like 40%, which is pretty bad, to be honest. A lot of people are just not showing up to vote. But something that could affect that even more is what we call voter suppression, which is accusations of basically things being put in place to make it harder for some people to vote. So that can be different things. It can be harder, harder identification needed, harder policies around identification. It can be polling place closures, or another thing that's quite common apparently now is voter roll purges. There has been accusation in the state of Georgia that we're talking about 340,000 electors that would have been removed from the rolls by the current Secretary of State, who also just happened to be a governor candidate, Brian Kemp. And what that means is that basically within a specific time frame, if you don't participate in elections, then you're automatically rolled out and cancelled. So you could show up to a poll, to a polling station and try and vote, but you would have been deregistered because you haven't taken part in previous elections. Obviously, you're not being warned about that, so that would be too easy. I mean, you get sent letters, which you have to send back after that, but I'm not sure when they actually do cancel your registration, if they tell you that you've been cancelled. So yeah, we're talking about actually quite a few people that could be hit by voter suppression policies. And we're also, interestingly, talking about people who tend to be minority voters and people from poorer socioeconomic backgrounds. Also people who just so happen to usually vote more for Democrats than Republicans. So that can have an influence on the final result. And it's not just me extrapolating. If you don't believe me, there's been academic studies, journalistic investigations, and court ruling that talk about the topic. So there's a predicted blue wave for Democrats at these midterm elections, but I don't really know if that's going to happen. So we're going to have to wait and see November 6th.
Thank you, Lisa.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for this week. A big thanks to all of those who spoke with us for the show today, Alan Blackman, Thomas Nash and David Menkes. And thank you to producers Ella Christensen and to Lisa Bode for that report. Very, very informative. Thank you. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thank you to all of you who tuned in. Ka hoki mai mātou ai tērā wiki. That's all from us today. We'll be back next week. Bridges up next with the 1 to 4. This is 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.